Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. LeBron took his talents to South Beach, but will he also bring the coveted Larry O'Brien Trophy? Ahead on Only a Game, a look ahead to the NBA Finals. Also, why there's perhaps only an American or two in Paris for the French Open. An appreciation of the Borg-McEnroe rivalry and the Kentucky Bee, featuring spellers above the legal drinking age. Also ahead, Charlotte Motor Speedway installs the world's largest HD screen.
There's going to be over 9 million LED light bulbs on the screen. So they tell me if you turned it facing upwards, you'd be able to see it from the moon.
And if you want to find out who will vie for Lord Stanley's Cup, stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Poke check, slap shot, high stick, score, one goal, plenty. Who needs more? Last night, the Boston Bruins beat the Tampa Bay Lightning 1-0. It is Boston that'll meet the Vancouver Canucks on Wednesday night in Vancouver to begin the Stanley Cup Finals. Joining me to preview those finals is Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Welcome back, Helene.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
The Bruins somehow managed to get by Tampa, which appeared at times to be the better team. Are you surprised to see those on-again, off-again Bruins in the finals?
I am a little bit, yeah. I mean, during the season, there were some ups and downs, and you kind of had to worry a little bit about Bergeron and little things here and there. And Tampa just seemed to be one of these upstart teams that, I hate the cliche, team of destiny, but they were really playing that way. And Roleson, 712 years old, or looking like it some days with that beard, but slight exaggeration, please. You kind of think, gee, maybe they're the team that's going to sneak up on everybody, but the Bruins really gritted this out. I mean, Tim Thomas was terrific. They got exactly what they needed from the role players. Chara was incredible. I mean, this was a very impressive effort.
How do the Bruins match up against Vancouver?
I think Vancouver is better. I know that's heresy, and you're going to be setting off the fire alarm in my Boston hotel for saying that. But I think maybe I'm a little biased. I see the West a lot more than I see the East. But I think the Canucks are deeper, and I think the one edge where the Bruins may have is in goal. I think Thomas could be the key for the Bruins. And Luongo seems to let in one bad goal a game. And that means that the Bruins, that means that the Canucks have to score at least two in order if they're going to win. So there's a lot of intriguing matchups here. It's the Cam Neely series, I guess. You know, he's played for both teams. So it's going to be fun.
All right, here's your chance to shine. How many games do the finals go, and who wins?
I don't want to break your heart, but I am going to pick the Canucks, and I'm going to say six.
Helene Elliott covers hockey for the LA Times. Honesty prevails once again. Helene, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
The NBA Finals begin Tuesday night when Miami hosts Dallas. The two teams also met in the 2006 Finals. The Mavericks still have sweet-shooting seven-footer Dirk Nowitzki, and the Heat still employ the scoring machine known as Dwayne Wade. So I'm really not sure what Sports Illustrated writer Chris Mannix and I have left to talk about, but since he's already on the line, we might as well give it a shot. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, good to be here.
On Thursday night, the Heat eliminated the Bulls in Game 5 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Chicago's Derrick Rose struggled for most of that series, and in the last two games, he took a total of 56 shots, made only 17 of them. What happened to the league's MVP?
Well, I think the league's MVP ran into a pretty good defense, specifically the defense of LeBron James. Throughout this postseason, one consistent theme with them has been that it's oftentimes been the Derrick Rose show, and it was successful in the first two rounds. But when they went up against Miami, which has an elite defender and a big defender in LeBron James, Derrick Rose ran into some trouble.
LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh are averaging collectively a total of more than 68 points per game in the playoffs. There are only two other players on the roster averaging more than six. So Miami's role players don't play much of a role, do they?
Well, I think that stat is a little bit misleading, only because Miami has gotten better throughout this postseason as they've gone along. I mean, I think you've seen the emergence of Mike Miller and Mario Chalmers off the bench in this conference finals. You've seen Joel Anthony step up and step into that starting role. So I think this Miami team is a little bit deeper than I think the numbers seem to indicate. Now, certainly, they go only as far as their big three is going to take them. If LeBron or Wade have a tough game in this NBA Finals against Dallas, chances are Dallas is going to have a very good chance at winning.
The Mavs knocked off Portland, the L.A. Lakers, and Oklahoma City to win in the West. This is Dallas' 11th straight NBA playoff appearance, and in three of the last 4 years, they were eliminated in the opening round. What's changed this time?
Well, I think two things have changed. I think that the addition of Tyson Chandler at the center position has made them more of a defensive-minded team. Now, if you recall, in the past, Dallas has never had a problem scoring against anyone. They just couldn't stop anyone. They're not necessarily an elite defensive team right now, but the addition of Chandler, who is a Kevin Garnett type of defender in that he is very athletic, contests a lot of shots, rebounds the ball exceptionally well, and I think that's been an invaluable addition to that team. And second, the evolution of Dirk Nowitzki has been pretty impressive, especially throughout this postseason. He's a much stronger guy, and he's a guy that you really can't push off that spot in the low post. And when he gets there, he's become such a very accomplished and complete post player that he's virtually impossible to stop.
Dirk Nowitzki is 32 years old, but he's a mere boy by Dallas standards. Sean Marion and Jason Terry are 33. Jason Kidd is 38 years old. Is there a fountain of youth somewhere in the Gatorade bucket behind the Mavs bench?
Well, there has to be in the case of Jason Kidd. But one thing I think you can say about this Dallas team and their older guys is that a lot of them have been near the mountaintop and not quite gotten there. I'm talking about Nowitzki and Jason Terry, who've been to one finals. Jason Kidd has been to two finals and lost. Tyson Chandler and Sean Marion have been deep into the playoffs and come up short. And I think that's a big weapon for them as far as motivation going into this NBA Finals.
All right, Chris, we've reached prediction time. Who gets to lift the Larry O'Brien Trophy, Big D or the Big Three?
I think Big D does, and I think it's going to be a very close series and a hotly contested series that goes the full seven games. But I like the fact that Dallas is more of a complete team. I expect LeBron James to have a monster series. I expect Dwayne Wade to have his big games. But I think in a seventh game that the Dallas Mavericks will come up big and they'll win this series.
Chris Mannix writes about the NBA for Sports Illustrated. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
May is Charlotte Motor Speedway's biggest month. Tomorrow, the track will host the second of two consecutive NASCAR weekends with the running of the Coca-Cola 600, and fans will be able to watch the world's largest HD video screen, which at 200 feet by 80 feet is wider and taller than the White House. Here's Speedway General Manager Marcus Smith.
There's going to be over 9 million LED light bulbs on the screen. So they tell me if you turned it facing upwards, you'd be able to see it from the moon.
The racetrack is one of the latest sports venues to upgrade its technology. The goal is to create an experience that surpasses what fans get at home through television, the internet, and their phones. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff reports.
I tell you, guy, I've been watching, Larry, is this cat right here in the sixth car. He's getting ready to jump all over Jeff Burton here for fourth. That little sixth car is moving.
Today's NASCAR broadcasts are better than ever. Yes, there's high-definition television, but also features that most fans can't get at the track. Fox Sports chairman and CEO David Hill is credited with many race broadcast innovations.
Everything from how much turn a driver is putting on the wheel, the pressure that's going on to the gas pedal, the pressure on the brakes, what the RPMs are going in the corners. It goes on and on and on.
Watch the race at home, and you can supplement the TV broadcast with content from a laptop or a phone. Fans who use Sprint's NASCAR app on their smartphone can actually listen in to driver crew chief communications.
Four tires. We can get it with the gas, man. Then we'll make sure we get it full. Four tires, guys. We'll have to come around to double zero.
Among the fans listening in is Dr. Josephine Koster. During the week, she's a professor at South Carolina's Winthrop University. But come the weekend, she's a high-tech NASCAR fan.
I'll have one laptop going where I've got the live scoring of the race up and have the radio broadcast going, because those announcers tend to give you a lot more detail about a lot more cars. I'll have another laptop up in which I'm following Twitter, participating in a chat room on a blog, and probably on one or two fan pages as well.
With an in-home experience like that, it's easy to see why some find it easier to save their money, avoid the crowds, and just watch from the couch. And many do. Baseball has seen an 8% decline in attendance since 2007. The NFL had more blackouts last year than in any year since 2004. NASCAR also has more empty seats. How many more isn't known, because NASCAR doesn't release its attendance figures. The NBA is the one exception. Its attendance was up this year, but by just 1%. The economy gets at least some of the blame for that. But David Holland of Cisco Systems says stadiums haven't kept up with the times.
People will show up at a venue and they'll find that the experience they have there is actually not at par even with what they can have in the home. And so all of these venue operators recognize this and see the potential for losing ticket sales and not being able to fill their venues.
Holland runs Cisco's Sports and Entertainment Division. Cisco created the unit 2.5 years ago to capitalize on the need for better stadium technology. Work so far has included outfitting the new Meadowlands Stadium, home to the New York Giants and the Jets, with more than 2,000 HD video screens. Other clients include the New York Yankees and the Dallas Cowboys. Brett Daniels is a spokesman for the Cowboys. He says the giant video board they installed in their new stadium gives fans a big TV to look at, just like in their living rooms at home, along with everything else that they can't get at home.
No matter what you do sitting at home, you can't replicate pumping in the sights, the sounds, the smells of 90,000, 100,000 people at a football game.
Giant video boards appear to be just the first step, and Holland, with Cisco Systems, says even he's not sure how exactly the stadium experience will change when all is said and done. But
one thing I do know is that it will be dramatically different than it is today. The acceleration in what's possible through internet technologies is going to make even things like three-dimensional holographic imaging possible. So it's very possible you could in your seat be watching multiple angles of the same play on a, not on a tablet, but perhaps on your lap, you know, play out again on your lap and share it with friends in the venue.
In the meantime, fans like Koster say they'd be happy with simpler upgrades, like Wi-Fi, so they can get online while they watch their favorite team. And with the way technology continues to evolve and the way ticket sales haven't, it's probably not a matter of if fans get such a wish, but just how soon they get it. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Braff in Charlotte.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If you go rafting without a life jacket on a river that's in the process of flooding, you may find yourself the object of a rescue search. Grace Nash and Bruce Crawford learned that last month after they were spotted on the Grand River in Ohio. The searchers spent hours looking for Nash and Crawford, who eventually made it to shore and then lied to the authorities about being in the water. The pair was eventually convinced to plead guilty to misdemeanor misconduct during an emergency. And then Nash and Crawford were sentenced to hand out water safety brochures while standing ankle deep in a tiny swimming pool at a festival in Plainsville, Ohio. After which, Ms. Nash assured reporters that she had learned her lesson while Mr. Crawford dried off his feet. But he probably learned his lesson too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new book about the rivalry between John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg. But first, on Thursday at the French Open, Marty Fish advanced to the tournament's third round. That wouldn't be such a big deal if Fish weren't the only American man still competing in France. Joining me now to comment on that circumstance and what else has been happening at the French Open is Sports Illustrated's L. John Wertheim. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Ah, good to be back. Thanks, Bill.
As I mentioned, Marty Fish is the lone remaining standard bearer for the U.S. on the men's side of the tournament. Is this symptomatic of the state of men's tennis in this country?
You know, it is. I mean, you pick the tournament at which American men have done worse for generations. But truthfully, it's not much better at the other events. These are not flush times for American tennis, and there are all sorts of theories why.
We have spoken to John McEnroe in the past about his prescription for developing new top-quality male competitors in the U.S. Has he or has anybody else made any progress along that line?
Not really. And I think all of this is wrong-headed. I mean, my prescription is stop rooting by country, because what's going on in tennis is sort of a microcosm of globalization more generally, that, you know, the talent pool has gotten infinitely deeper, and they're playing tennis everywhere in the world now. They weren't a generation ago. And my prescription is that people just stop looking at country codes and root for players, because if you're banking on an American or an American generation sort of reclaiming what we had, you know, up until now, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah, so that's an interesting perspective. How much does the country matter? I know British fans would love to see a Brit win at Wimbledon, but do tennis fans from other countries worry about these things?
You know, they do, and it's funny because the four countries that host the Grand Slam tournaments seem and have the most money seem to worry about it more than anyone. Sort of this wealth corrupts theory. But, I think tennis is such a global sport. It's not just that the players are coming from all over the place. It's that the events are all over the place, too. I mean, I think that's what's been overlooked. It used to be the circuit was largely based in North America. Well, that's not true anymore. And I think that has as much to do with sort of tennis's changing demographic as anything else. So you can't turn on the TV at 4 p.m. on a Sunday and necessarily expect to see an American event. But I think it's just a lost cause. I mean, if you look at the top 10, there have been times when 10 different countries have been represented. And if the Antarctic Federation would ever get its act together, you'd have all seven continents. I mean, it's really a global sport. And you want to say it's just asinine to expect it's sort of arrogant, as well as asinine to expect your country to produce this wildly disproportionate number of players.
Among the very accomplished players who didn't show up for this tournament were Venus and Serena Williams. I guess it doesn't help when two of the top women in the world don't come.
Yeah, I mean, the Williams sisters at this stage in the game, I think their combined age is about 60 right now, and they're sort of at that time, their bodies are breaking down a little. They've always had these outside interests, and if you sort of remove them from the equation, the picture is even more grim for American women.
A couple of U.S. women, Vanya King and Bethany Mattek-Sands, did enjoy some success in this tournament, although Mattek-Sands lost to Yelena Yankovic in the third round. But the story so far on the women's side seems to be the ousting of favorites. Were you surprised to see number two seed Kim Clijsters and Caroline Wozniacki, number one in the world, bounced out so early?
Yes and no. I mean, those results were very surprising. Not often you see the top two seeds eliminated the first week. But, you know, the women's field right now resembles sort of like, the Republican presidential pool. It's sort of all over the map, and the field is wide open. And, you know, it's been this way for a few years. The Williams sisters are great players, but they don't play particularly consistently. And nobody else has really filled that vacuum. And it's sort of been this sort of alternating number ones. And the number one player now, Caroline Wozniacki, has never won a Grand Slam, which has been the source of some concern. And, you know, you don't expect the top two seeds to go out this early, but it's very much in keeping with sort of the narrative of women's tennis these days.
That was a very interesting comparison, and I'm not sure who should be flattered and who should be insulted, the Republican candidates or the women tennis players.
And not often Caroline Wozniacki's been likened to Mitt Romney. Is that what you're saying?
All right, let's get a little more upbeat. Tell us about a player on the women's side who has been especially impressive.
Well, there are a couple, and we sort of have this German tennis sort of mini boomlet. After Steffi Graf, German tennis sort of faltered a little bit. Now we have a number of nice German players, Andrea Petkovic. The media likes her because she's outspoken, and the fans like her because she does a little dance when she wins, and she's a very nice player. And there's another player, Julia Georges, that nobody'd really heard of. There are some of these players that are coming through the ranks. I mean, Maria Sharapova's had a nice sort of mini comeback. If she wins this French Open, she'll have won all four majors. I mean, there are a lot of nice potential storylines, but you don't have, I mean, on the men's side, we have these really two and three dominating forces. The women's side is wide open. It's a very interesting contrast. It's sort of what do fans prefer, these sort of mini dynasties, or else this any given Sunday anyone can win. And I mean, the two tours are at very sort of, they're really at polar opposites right now, where the men's tour has really two or three viable candidates to win this, and the women's tour has about a dozen.
When you talk about overwhelming forces, Novak Djokovic's perfect season has been the headline story in tennis this year. I wonder, has his performance overshadowed everything else that's been happening at this tournament?
So far, yeah. I mean, so far, he really is the story in tennis right now. And, you know, for a good half decade, we had this great rivalry. We had Nadal and Federer and these two. I mean, you could make the case either of them are the greatest of all time. I mean, these tremendous champions. And now we're sort of this embarrassment of riches. Now we have this third guy coming up who's put together a six-month winning streak. So right now, he really is the story. One thing it's over, I mean, for better or worse, Djokovic has sort of overshadowed one of the not-so-nice stories, which is sort of this decline of Roger Federer, who just, you know, we're so accustomed. He sort of set this impossible bar, sort of a victim of his own standards, but he's not sort of clearly not the player he once was, and that's really been overshadowed by Djokovic and his unbeaten streak as well.
All right, I know this tournament has a ways to go, but you want to go out on a limb and pick a winner for us on each side?
Well, Mitch Daniels is out, so we can't use him. But, no, I think Djokovic is probably... I pick Nadal just on track record, but I think, you know, realistically, Djokovic is probably playing better tennis right now. And the women's side, who knows? I mean, Maria Sharapova would be a nice story, nice boost for the tour. Svetlana Kuznetsova, who's won this event before, is another candidate. But the women's side is still absolutely wide open.
L. John Wertheim writes about tennis and various other things for Sports Illustrated. He's also the author of many books, among them Strokes of Genius and Scorecasting. John, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill. Anytime.
Part of what energized the rivalry between Bjorn Borg, who won 11 Grand Slam singles titles between 1974 and 1981, and John McEnroe, who won 7 between 79 and 84, was the contrast between the two. It would be an oversimplification to say Borg was ice and McEnroe was fire, but the temptation is there. In High Strung, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, and the untold story of tennis's fiercest rivalry, Stephen Tignor writes about the competition and about lots of other players who thrived while Borg and McEnroe excelled. Stephen Tignor joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Some of your readers will be surprised, I think, to learn that when he was a juniors player, Bjorn Borg was as likely to throw rackets and scream at linesmen as John McEnroe ever was. What caused Borg to change?
Yeah, he said when he was younger that he called himself a madman. He would accuse people of cheating. He lost a crucial junior match because he flipped out. He walked across the net, got in his opponent's face, and it hurt him, and he lost that match, and he decided after that he just had to control it. But he just learned from that and never did it again.
Well, he not only made the decision, he did it spectacularly. I mean, he became more controlled than any player most people had ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny to watch old tapes of him. I'd forgotten how there's no expression from one point to the next. Simply walks. He could lose, you know, the biggest point you can imagine. Just walks to the other side of the net, other side of the court. Nothing.
Even during the days when he was known as the Iceman, Borg was spectacularly superstitious. His fiancée, Mariana Simonescu, believed that superstitions and habits were, quote, a source of energy and concentration. Was she right about that?
Yeah, he, you know, his parents were incredibly superstitious. They came to Wimbledon one year that he won, and they came to the French Open the next year that he won. So they decided that from then on they would alternate years that they would go to those two tournaments. They never went 2 years in a row. And it worked. He won all of those tournaments. He took it beyond the court into just every part of his life was devoted to tennis and to having some kind of control over everything he did. Even if it was the number of towels he used on a tennis court, it always had to be two.
I think that the single weirdest story about superstitions is that his fiancée would eat candy throughout his match, and she stopped eating the candy at one point when it seemed a sure thing that he would win, and when he mm-hmm. lost a point, she took the candy which she had taken out of her mouth and popped it back in just to make sure.
Yeah, it was Borg's mother. Borg's mother did that in 1979 Wimbledon. Borg had 3 match points at the end of a long match, so she finally was sick of this candy she'd been chewing the entire time. She spit it out on the floor. Borg lost the next 3 points. She picked it up off the floor, put it back in her mouth. He won the next 2 points. So, you know, that worked.
John McEnroe, who did not begin winning Grand Slam tournaments until Borg had won most of his, said that Borg was the guy who made him feel as if he belonged at the top of the tennis heap. How did Borg do that?
At a match in New Orleans in 1979 when McEnroe was young and McEnroe was going crazy. At the end of a match, Borg called him up to the net, and McEnroe was thinking, what's he going to say to me? Is he going to say I'm the biggest jerk in the world? And Borg said, just calm down. It's a great match. This is a great match. And McEnroe never really forgot that he felt that that was one. He felt that he got some recognition as a great player from Borg, just to get it from the one player of that year that he really revered. Mm-hmm. He had complete respect for him. And to get that from Borg, McEnroe said it felt like champion to champion stuff. And sort of after that, he felt like he, you know, Borg recognized something in him, and that helped McEnroe believe in himself.
Just for the fun of it, could it be argued that the rivalry between Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer is as fierce as the one between Borg and McEnroe was?
Yeah, it's gone on longer, and they've had more great matches. Borg and McEnroe, they had great matches, and they were finished 7-7, so they were dead even when they finished, and they were complete opposites. They really were. Federer and Nadal are not the characters that these guys are. They're not the sort of complete opposites, but their matches have been, they've had more great matches on big stages just because they've been around longer. Borg quit when he was 26, so mm-hmm. if he'd stuck around for 5 more years, maybe Borg and McEnroe would have. So yeah, Federer and Nadal is, you know, it's right up there with Borg and McEnroe.
At the end of your book, you describe Bjorn Borg's exit from the 1981 U.S. Open, and you write, Borg swept his long hair out of his eyes and thought, for the first time in his life, I'm free. Were you taking some poetic license with that sentence?
Well, he did say that he felt free. Some of the people around him said that Borg really yearned for anonymity because he'd never known it. He started playing tennis when he was 9. He became a professional when he was 14. And by the time he was 25, he was talking about how he just wanted to cut off his hair and go somewhere and play hockey and not be known by anybody. And he was famous when he was 14, played constantly, whether he was playing matches or exhibitions, for 10 years. It had been a long time, anyway, since he felt free from tennis or felt like he was doing what he really wanted to do.
What about John McEnroe? Has he managed to leave the game behind happily besides these exhibitions that he sometimes plays?
I think he's done well. I think he struggled. When Borg retired, McEnroe felt like he lost his main reason for playing. He was there was the one guy that he wanted to play. McEnroe went on to play great tennis, but he thought he didn't really achieve everything he should have. He also won his last Grand Slam when he was 25 and felt like he didn't do everything he could have. But in the years since, I think he's carved out a pretty good life that he likes as a tennis announcer. He's in the public eye. He plays amazing tennis now. He's certainly the best 50-year-old player who's ever played tennis. And, you know, he still gets angry and still gets frustrated and probably looks back on his career as a little bit of a disappointment, but I think he seems like he enjoys his life, and he's been able to find something that he really liked to do, which is, I think, is tough for some of these athletes.
Stephen Tignor is the author of High Strung, Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, and the Untold Story of Tennis's Fiercest Rivalry, published by Harper. The author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Stephen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Out. What? Out. What? The ball was out.
You gotta be kidding! The ball's in! Everyone can see that the ball's in!
You're listening to Only a Game. A little later on today, Manchester United and Barcelona will meet in London's Wembley Stadium to determine the champion of the Champions League. This soccer game will be the culmination of a competition that saw professional teams from Germany, Russia, Turkey, France, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Portugal, as well as England and Spain, advance to the group stage of the tournament. The earlier stages involved places lots of U.S. citizens would be challenged to find on a map. Meanwhile, FIFA, International Soccer's governing body, is supposed to be electing its next president shortly. Until late Thursday, it could have been confidently supposed that the winner in that competition would be Sepp Blatter, who's been running FIFA since 1998. His opponent, Mohammed bin Hammam of Qatar, who is the president of the Asian Football Federation, had been charged with offering bribes to members of the Caribbean Football Union in exchange for their votes. But as of yesterday, it became apparent that electors who figured they should vote for the guy who wasn't bogged down in a corruption investigation had a problem. Mohammed bin Hammam asked FIFA to investigate Mr. Blatter as well. He alleges that Blatter knew about various instances of corruption and failed to report them, which would constitute a violation of FIFA's rules. Major League Baseball has its steroid stories. The NFL, which has locked out its players, is still trying to figure out how to spin the fact that lots of the league's veterans have suffered work-related brain damage. The NHL has concussion issues of its own. The NBA weathered a scandal which saw one longtime official cashiered for betting on games he was working, and that league seems poised to lock out the players, too. The challenge for fans, at least when they are watching the shortstop scoop up a ground ball and flip it to the second baseman to begin a double play, or the wide receiver juggle and then haul in a long pass in full stride, or the goalie stretch to make an apparently impossible save, or the power forward create an improbable shot in a forest of long arms, is to enjoy the athletic gems despite the discouraging business stories and the posturing of those involved in running the games. A little later on today, I will pull on my Barcelona jersey, the one that says UNICEF on the front. I will choose from my shelf one of my Barcelona caps and one of my Barcelona scarves. And then I will sit down in front of the very large television set in the home of a friend who will be rooting hard for Manchester United. For 90 minutes, neither of us will say a word about Sepp Blatter, Mohammed bin Hammam, or any of the other six FIFA bigwigs who've been charged with corruption. We will watch and enjoy the game. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Charlie Craig, a 10-year-old girl in Glasgow, Scotland, began lifting weights because her older brother was doing it. It soon became apparent that Miss Craig had talent, and now she's lifting her own body weight, about 70 pounds, above her head. She was recently named Britain's strongest schoolgirl, and she attributes her success in part to adults in the gym where she trains. "When I can't do it, they say, up, up, up," Charlie said. She trains for 12 hours a week, which is not without consequence. "It's really hard work," she says, "and I'm sore most of the time. But then I look back, and I'm happy with what I've done." Nobody's gonna be bigger than I. Work it out now. Come play up now. Work it out now. Ah. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, A-S-T-O-R-Y, about S-P-E-L-L-I-N-G. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Vancouver Canucks have been enjoying some well-earned rest since securing their spot in the NHL Finals on Tuesday. Do the Boston Bruins stand any chance against the mighty Canucks?
I don't think so, if only because the world seems to be conspiring to make Roberto Luongo the most beloved figure in Canada since Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather, who invented universal health care. I mean, not only does the guy help Canada get a gold medal in 2010 in Vancouver, he's got a chance to win the Stanley Cup for his hometown, too.
It's Miami against Dallas in the NBA Finals. Who wins in the battle between the two teams that both play in arenas named for American Airlines?
I hate this, by the way. I really hate that the two teams are playing in arenas named after the same airline. I hate naming rights anyway, but this is really awful. I think this is going to really disappoint people who are predisposed not to like the Miami Heat. But the Miami Heat can score 14 points in a row on anybody. The only thing they have to do is decide to do it in the fourth quarter, which is pretty much what they did against Chicago. I think they deny Mark, the world's smartest human Cuban, his chance at an NBA championship, for which I will be eternally grateful.
Jason Terry is perhaps the happiest of all the Mavericks players that his team made the finals. Charlie, why is that?
Because he tattooed the Larry O'Brien trophy on his bicep before the start of the season. So he would have looked really goofy at home, lounging around the pool, having a trophy on his arm that he did not win in practice.
I guess we better enjoy what's left of the NBA season, because this week the Players Union filed an unfair labor practice complaint against the league. Based on this and other recent developments, do you think the NBA will go the way of the National Football League, which is to court?
I think it's definitely going to go to court, and I think this one is going to be considerably uglier than the NFL lockout has been, and the NFL lockout's been pretty ugly.
Tomorrow, 33 drivers will try to finish 200 laps in the 100th anniversary of the Indianapolis 500. Charlie, you got a winner for us?
Yes, somebody with a name like an Italian astronaut will win.
There you go.
That's my guess. I don't know, Bill.
Simple.
It's entirely possible that Dario Franchitti or Scott Dixon will win. It's entirely possible that neither one of them will.
Uh-huh.
Gentlemen, start your ambiguity.
Race car drivers are not known for being terribly welcoming of female drivers in their number, Charlie, but this week they're all saying nice things about 22-year-old Swiss driver Simone DiSilvestro. What has she done to earn the respect of her fellow drivers?
She's driving with pain. She burned both of her hands last week when she car hit a wall during a practice lap, and she qualified easily to make the field, and she will now be the favorite of the fans there.
It's hard to repeat as champs in baseball. It got harder for the San Francisco Giants on Wednesday night.
Yeah, it was a baseball play out of 1918 or something. Buster Posey, the very talented catcher for San Francisco, was blocking the plate in the 12th inning, and a Marlins player named Scott Cousins came in and pretty much trashed his ankle, which would probably put him out for the rest of the year.
In other Giants news, police in L.A. have arrested a 31-year-old gang member in connection with a beating of Giants fan Brian Stowe. Stowe is still under heavy sedation after being assaulted in the Dodgers parking lot on opening day. Barry Bonds, late of those Giants, has volunteered to pay for the college educations of Stowe's two children. Did that gesture surprise you?
Does it surprise me? I hate to say it surprises me because it makes me sound like one of those people who are enormously cynical that Barry Bonds is doing this for X, Y, and Z reasons. This is first-class stepping up, and I really hope the Stowe family accepts the offer.
The New York Mets will apparently be getting a $200 million infusion of cash. Charlie, hedge fund manager David Einhorn will buy a minority share of the team, but the current owners will stay in control. By all accounts, this Einhorn is a pretty smart guy when it comes to money, so why is he investing in the Mets?
What can possibly go wrong with a hedge fund manager? What could possibly go wrong with this deal? Much less leaving the current brainiacs in charge.
The offices of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers will be closed this week as employees take their first unpaid furlough. If the labor dispute between the players and owners is resolved without the loss of any regular season games, the employees will be paid for their unpaid week off. We hope none of them are counting on that money to pay the rent.
General manager's taking a pay cut. Owner of the team taking a pay cut. Until there is, don't ask me to be sympathetic of the people you are giving furlough days to because of a lockout you promoted. So, no, I'm not going to weep the crocodile tears the Tampa Bay Buccaneers management wants me to weep.
In this week's Sports Illustrated, former and potentially future running back Tiki Barber made an unfortunate analogy. He said that the time he spent hiding from paparazzi in his agent's attic was, quote, like a reverse Anne Frank thing. Some have said the statement was, quote, outrageous and perverse. You want to weigh in on that?
I think what Tiki did was say something that was like a reverse really smart thing. First of all, you are using the iconic death of a child to explain what it was like hiding with your girlfriend after you broke up with your pregnant wife.
Mm.
So not only are you using a completely tasteless analogy, you're using it to explain a completely tasteless moment in your life. Nicely done, Tiki.
Former Ohio State wide receiver Ray Small told the student newspaper that he sold Big Ten championship rings for cash and got sweetheart deals on cars while he was playing for Ohio State. Ohio State responded by saying they do not have enough information to launch an investigation. Isn't the student newspaper delivered to the athletic department?
I like that. The athletic department admitting that the student newspaper knows more about this stuff than the athletic department does. I do have a question, though. Why shouldn't this guy be able to sell his Big Ten championship ring?
The NCAA Infractions Appeals Committee has denied appeals by USC to ease off on the penalties previously assessed to the football program there. What sort of impact will these penalties have on the university, Charlie?
A considerable one in the short term, for sure. But I think USC is still a brand name. And I still, when they get out from under this, it will not be SMU. It will not take them that long to get their football program back.
Finally, Charlie, why don't you just say sports in a kind of preemptive way?
Sports!
There we go. And then you can reveal why listeners in Texas, partial to a particular kind of fishing, are getting ready to celebrate.
First of all, I don't know why this has been illegal in Texas all these years, but apparently the bill is moving through the legislature that will make noodling, which is catching catfish with your hands, legal in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
It's only allowed in 17 other states. I don't imagine, you know, people in like upstate Minnesota want to do this because the water's really cold. But in the South, and by the way, just so you know, it has its own television program. It's called Barehanded Fishing.
Oh, man.
You can watch the noodling competition.
Now you can watch it in Texas. Charlie Fierce is the author of Idiot America, as well as several other books, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Last week's show, splendidly hosted by Only a Game producer Karen Given, featured Karen's story about greyhounds running for the fun of it rather than to break the hearts of the betting public. According to his Facebook post, Robert Rudolph loved it. Great story, he wrote. You can hear the joy in the dogs. Denise Gray also enjoyed that story, although she was a little irked that Karen said Irish deerhounds when referring to some deerhounds that were in fact Scottish. Karen apparently failed to discern the accents when the dogs barked, but she wanted me to assure all our listeners that she has no trouble telling one accent from the other when it's people who are involved. Only a Game producer Doug Trabue's story in last week's program also provoked lots of comment. He examined what the Thunder left behind when they stopped being the Seattle Supersonics and moved to Oklahoma. More than one listener saw that story as an opportunity to characterize Clay Bennett, the former owner of the team that was the Sonics, in exceedingly derogatory terms. In the scrum that developed on our website and our Facebook page after the story aired, one Thunder fan wrote, "No one in Oklahoma cares about the Sonics' garbage history. If you all miss the team so much, maybe you should have went to the games and filled the seats and give them a reason to stay instead of feeling sorry for yourself and crying about it." In response to a beard and mustache competition mentioned a while back on the program, Dave Pearson emailed us about a fellow who'd won a recent facial hair contest in Norway by styling his beard and mustache to resemble a moose and the Norwegian flag. Mr. Pearson began that email by writing, "I'm never quite sure where the edge of sporting competition comes for your purposes, and neither am I, and part of the fun of coming to work is exploring that matter." You can comment on the competitions we discuss or anything else by visiting our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And you can follow us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Gladiolus. In 1925, 11-year-old Frank Neuhauser from Louisville, Kentucky, spelled that word correctly to win the first-ever National Spelling Bee. That bee evolved into the annual Scripps Spelling Bee, which begins next Tuesday in Maryland. Preteens in the Scripps Bee have won with adroit spellings of Smaragdine and, in two consecutive years, Esquamalos. With national sponsorship and network coverage, the Scripps Bee has become a national institution and a serious competition, but every month, back in the Bee's home city of Louisville, a new old group of spellers is taking things a little less seriously. WFBL's Gabe Bullard reports.
It's a Thursday night at Zanzibar, a bar in Louisville's hip Germantown neighborhood. Patrons wear bee suits, drink, and compete as teams in a spelling bee similar to the Scripps National Bee. I've never been to the Scripsby, but I'm guessing it doesn't sound like this when someone spells quidnunc with a K instead of a C.
I'm so sorry.
You know, number one, that's the booze, I'd say, more than anything. But no, I don't know. People get really excited about it in the same way that, you know, they get excited about, I don't know. I can't think of a good example.
That's Emily Forrester. She started the new Spelling Bee, which she spells S-P-L-E-L-I-N-G-B-E, last winter.
I was determined to get people out of their houses and do something, and I was watching Spellbound. And thought to myself, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen a spelling bee. Why are there no chances for adults to compete in them? I want to do one, and it'd be hilarious if we did it at a bar. Why not?
In 1 year, attendance to the bee has tripled, and this January's competition is the biggest yet. 44 teams of one, two, or three players signed up. Forrester is impressed, but she's not entirely surprised. She says there's something about the bee that brings out the crowds, and it's not necessarily the booze. That's boozes and alcohol, not the plural of boo.
And I remember when I started talking about this idea to people, instead of responding like, oh yeah, that'd be a great idea, they would immediately tell me a story about, oh, I lost my fifth grade spelling bee, I lost on the word strawberry, are you kidding me? And then they would spell it for me right then and there. So that was a signal to me that, you know, this is burned in people's brains.
And she's right. Here are a few competitors.
I'm ashamed to admit it was the word angry. I spelled A-N-R-G-Y.
Won at the school, went on to the regionals, got down to me and one other guy. I don't remember what I lost on, but I remember his word, whetstone. I remember it because the judge was very careful to say, whetstone. Whetstone, listen carefully.
I got out on the word chrysanthemum. So I looked it up today before I came, because it would just be horrible to get the word wrong twice.
How do you spell it?
C-H-R... Oh, you're going to put me on the spot. C-H-R-Y-N-T-H-E-M-U-M?
That's not exactly right, but she's not the only one who studied before coming to the Bee. Jenny Whitlock spent the afternoon with a dictionary.
We've got onomatopoeia, down.
How do you spell it?
You can spell it to the tune of Old MacDonald Had a Farm, and it's O-N-O-M-A-T-O-P-O-E-I-A.
Whitlock also took the time to find a costume before leaving the house. Anyone who competes in the bee dressed as a bee gets one round of immunity. But the second round is when the competition gets serious. Forrester didn't just grab these words out of a dictionary. These are graduate school entrance exam type words. They're arduous, Herculean, onerous, labyrinthine. They're really tough.
Okay, your word is proselytize. Agon, also pronounced agon, internecine, internecine, or internecine. Subfusc. Subfusc. Your word is supererogatory.
For all the fun people are having, there's also learning going on in the bar tonight. And high school chemistry teacher Mark Amick says the competitors, even the drunk, bee-suited hipsters, are doing their part to set a good example for future generations.
A lot of kids talk about loosing an electron instead of losing an electron, and it drives me crazy. But, you know, basic things, spelling flower as though it's a rose instead of the ingredient in bread. That sort of thing. And nothing, you know, no spell checker will catch that. We're not a civilized society anymore when it comes to that. Everybody waits for the red squiggly.
But there aren't any youngsters at the Bee. It's 21 and over only. As the night and the words get longer, the attempted spellings get more creative. For some, it's the intoxicants, but other competitors are done in by French origins, silent H's, and inconsistent applications of the I before E rule. After about 2 hours, there are two teams left. Of the remaining teams, one misses the silent CH in thonic. The last team has to spell two words right in a row to win.
Triskaidekaphobia.
It's a doozy, but...
T-R-I-S-K-A-I-D-E-K-A-P-H-O-B-I-A. That is correct.
After that one, the final word seems mundane. It's inveigle, a word meaning to persuade through flattery.
I-N-V-E-I-G-L-E.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have winners!
Teammates Sean Ryan and Mike Tobolewski take first prize. Tobolewski has known this victory before. He's basically the Los Angeles Lakers of the Louisville Spelling Bee.
So it's my third win. I've always been a word enthusiast, and I've always had a competitive streak, so it kind of lets me channel that.
Forrester hopes that kind of competitiveness is widespread. Aside from monthly competitions in Louisville, she's looking into holding bees in other cities.
Chicago, Nashville, Bloomington, big college town, that would be in a lot of hipsters in Bloomington. Pittsburgh, we're talking about doing one in Silicon Valley, Denver, Austin, maybe New York.
And where do you hope it goes from here?
Probably intergalactic, Gabe, I mean.
Until then, monthly spelling bees are still planned for Louisville, tentatively at this same venue, called Zanzibar. Incidentally, the bar's name is misspelled, with an A after the second Z instead of an I. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe Bullard in Louisville.
We are fearless spellers who love fairy words. We're the nerds with the dictionary on our knees.
Underrate us
with our chronic congestion.
Or debate us.
That's a stupid suggestion.
Cause we'll pommel your butt when we prove who knows what.
Though we're frightened by the sound of the bell.
We love words, 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 we love spelling.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Gabe Bullard's Spelling Bee Photo Gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Only a Game's Gary Wallach, who spells 2011 NBA champion.
M-A-V-E-R-I-C-K.
Well, not if Miami head coach Eric Spoelstra, S-P-O-E-L-S-T-R-A, has anything to say about T-H-I-N-G-S. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next W-E-E-K.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, working to use video games to improve health at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.